Morning, Ms. Dyer.
Good morning, and may it please the court. Beverly Dyer on behalf of Manuel De Jesus Ventura. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. In the last appeal, applying Taylor and Shepard, this court found that a proffer by the Commonwealth of Virginia was insufficient to establish the nature of Mr. Ventura's prior abduction offense and that it was a crime of violence under the sentencing guidelines. First, nothing distinguishes that rule from a finding that the same rule should apply under 3553A, under Section 3553A. Second, the quantity of evidence required for a finding of violence under the for a crime of violence finding under the guidelines, essentially any finding of violence would have qualified the offense for that finding. Therefore, the district court could not have found as a factual matter that the offense was in any way violent based on some lower level of violence in this case. If Shepard applies at all in the context of the guidelines.
If the evidence were sufficient, the facts allegedly established by it would qualify as a crime of violence, would they not? I want to make sure I understood your position correctly.
If there were Shepard qualified evidence, if there were evidence,
there were sufficient evidence
that was permissible to consider under Shepard.
Yeah, so your position is not that this wouldn't qualify as a crime of violence if properly proven, only that it hasn't been properly proven. Is that correct?
That there is insufficient evidence, that,
right.
That the only evidence produced was this proffer, and that is insufficient evidence to show either a crime of violence or the nature of the offense for any other reason at sentencing. Once this court has applied Shepard to the sentencing guidelines, there is no legal standard that would permit a different quantity of evidence or a different type of finding under any other sentencing for it, the purposes of any other sentencing fact.
The standard here is preponderance. We've said that facts found in a pre-sentence report, if not objected to, may be accepted. We have the no contest plea, and we have no effort by defense counsel at any point that I can find to challenge the underlying facts here, to say in essence that the girl was making up the story about the abduction.
There is no obligation for the defense to dispute facts. There has to be some threshold.
We're not talking about obligations. We're talking about sufficiency.
I agree.
The standard is preponderance, and given our precedence on the pre-sentence report, and which I think logically.
First of all, we did object to the pre-sentence report in 2005, but on the
not on this ground.
Well, I would argue that it was broader.
It's on the ground that the facts didn't qualify as a crime of violence. It wasn't on the ground that the facts were incorrect, that the girl in the abduction was making up the story.
Even if that is this court's conclusion, there has to be some threshold for a preponderance finding that does not require a dispute.
But you could have sought to challenge this before the district court. This is sandbagging the district court in some respects because you don't raise it to the district court.
Mr. Ventura had a right to remain silent with respect to any criminal allegations.
No doubt, the defense
did. That's right. That's true in a criminal trial.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean you can't convict him, that he remains silent, that he exercises his right to remain
silent. That is also true at sentencing under Mitchell. And this
right, but even though he has a right to remain silent, the defense counsel can say to the judge that the defendant's not going to testify, but we challenge the accuracy of this fact that's asserted in the pre-sentence report. For example, you could have sought testimony from the girl, the victim.
Why is it our obligation to put on testimony if the evidence is insufficient?
Because there's no contest plea plus a fact in the pre-sentence report, and under our precedence, you're well aware that those facts, therefore, will satisfy the preponderance obligation unless you do something.
It was clear to all counsel that once the government produced the transcript of this proffer, that was the source or the only evidence supporting the pre-sentence reports.
We're not quite sure what's wrong with that.
What's wrong with relying on the proffer?
Yeah. You're in criminal court an awful lot. I spent a lot of my life in criminal court. And when you're looking back at past convictions, you don't go back and retry that case. If you have something wrong with it, I mean, the prosecution presents it. This is the record. This is what we have against the defendant with reference to that prior event. Nobody's saying the defendant has an obligation to come forward with anything at that point, but At that point, that's what the judge has before him. That's what the judge had here.
The essence of our disputes was, and the only thing we were required to do was to say to the government, you have an obligation to prove this by a preponderance of the evidence. Mm-hmm. We don't have an obligation to say it didn't happen that way, because that would put defense counsel and the client on in a Fifth Amendment
bond.
How do
we deal with, for example, our Price case, which says that the fact alleged in the pre-sentence report are good enough?
In Carter, this court recognized that if the defendant is asking for alleges that the evidence is insufficient, and I can explain why this proffer was insufficient following this, but if the evidence is insufficient, then we do not have an obligation to come forward with any affirmative statement disputing, contradicting the proffer.
Nobody is imposing an obligation. You can stand silent in every sentencing and let the courts based on the government's evidence. We're not talking about obligation. We're talking about a preponderance here.
Well, I would submit that...
And what you say that the proffer was insufficient. What was insufficient?
Because a prosecutor does not have first-hand knowledge of an offense. That knowledge has to be second or third-hand.
Yeah,
there is nothing
exactly.
at all.
And that's going to be the case in the vast majority of criminal cases that come into court.
Unless the government brings into the federal sentencing hearing the witness or victim, and then the district court judge can assess the credibility or reliability.
You didn't ask for that. Sorry.
Go ahead.
We asked for the government to prove by a preponderance.
Could have asked the district judge or said, we object because it was a no-contest plea, so it wasn't a guilty plea, and so therefore, judge, you should hear from the girl, the victim. Now, I can imagine that there was a strategic decision that wouldn't have been helpful.
Wouldn't have been a good idea, no.
There's no, this court cannot assume anything about that witness or victim
would have
said.
I agree, I'm not assuming, I'm just,
and,
I
and
threw it out as
a possibility. And we have no obligation to say anything more than...
We read the record.
Excuse me.
We read the record. We're not assuming. Don't accuse this court of assuming. We read the record. And I'm not at all certain why, as a matter of initio, if we didn't have the first place in this one, why there's anything wrong with relying on the record in the original plea.
Because there's no way to assess the credibility or reliability of the victim or witness in
that
case.
If that's the best you've got, then you have virtually ruled out the use of prior convictions in sentencing. Or for any other purpose.
This issue pervaded the Shepherd decision, and the court there ruled that more was required. The lower court in Shepherd, the Court of Appeals in Shepherd, found that the evidence was undisputed there. This police report was undisputed. The dissent based a large part of its conclusions on the fact that the police report in that case was undisputed, that the defendant did not come forward and say anything about that.
That was a police report, right?
Yes, and...
This is a transcript of a plea proceeding in which the defendant did not contest. Did not admit, but he did not contest the statement of what the offense is.
No reason for the defendant...
Do you not see a difference between that and a police report?
There's no reason for the defendant to contest anything at that plea colloquy. All the defendant had to say was, I plead nolo contendere. That's all the defendant did say.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all this court can conclude is from the information or indictment in that case and the plea, the abduction offense to which the defendant pled. There is nothing this court can conclude or the district court could conclude based on the government's proffer when there is no information about where the information of that proffer came from. There's no assessment of the credibility of anyone. There's no way to evaluate whether that was reliable. If that's this court's ruling, that would be a due process violation because there is no actual evidence. There is no evidence other than third or fourth.
I don't see any of what you're saying now ever said to the district court.
This pervaded the three sentencing hearings and the two appeals.
I looked at them. I don't see this argument that you're making now in those hearings.
Those hearings were founded on, there's no way to...
To be fair, most of the argument was about whether the facts or the prior conviction qualified as a crime of violence. I understand that.
And this court ruled that they did not and that the district court could not rely on the proffer for that finding. The government has not pointed to, and I'm not aware of, any legal standard for which a different preponderance ruling would apply to a guidelines finding and a 3553A finding, or to any finding under sentencing. under sentencing law. The district court is required to assess facts, and here the court was not permitted to conclude from the proffer that this offense involved the facts alleged in that proffer. I see that I am out of time, and this court has no further questions.
Thank you. We'll give you back a couple of minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. We'll hear from the government. Morning, counsel.
May it please the court. Good morning, Your Honors. Michelle Shamblin Stratton on behalf of the United States. I'd like to begin, as this court's questions have indicated, with the procedural claim that Mr. Ventura poses, and then we'll move to the substantive reasonableness claim and the Sixth Amendment violation. Before the district court, Mr. Ventura's only objection was against the use of the PSR and the proffer to establish that his prior abduction conviction was for a crime of violence, as enumerated under the guidelines in this case. He never objected before the district court to the use of the PSR, the proffer, as insufficient to meet the government's burden to prove facts beyond by a preponderance of the evidence. He never questioned the accuracy of those facts. He never claimed that the court's consideration of those facts would be an end run around this court's ruling in 2009 or an end run around Shepard. I feel it's important to address Mr. Ventura's counsel's assertions about sufficiency for Shepard purposes and sufficiency for fact-finding at sentencing generally. Shepard is not, as Mr. Ventura has asserted in his reply brief, a limitation on the evidence that a district court can consider in making fact-finding about the nature of a prior offense. Shepard limits the set of evidence that a district court can consider to determine that a defendant was necessarily convicted of the elements of a generic offense as enumerated under the statutes and guidelines provisions. The standard of proof at sentencing is a preponderance of the evidence. And the Supreme Court recently reaffirmed in Pepper versus United States, as codified in 18 U.S.C. 3661, that the general standard of sentencing is that a district court is not limited in the kinds or sources of evidence that it can consider for purposes of fact-finding at sentencing. There are lots of facts, Your Honors, that satisfy the preponderance of the evidence standard, but that would not satisfy Shepard. Acquitted conduct, as this court held in Dorsley. Untried conduct, as this court held in Bross. Testimony at a jury trial. It's for that reason that Mr. Ventura's failure to object to anything but the sufficiency of the proffer for satisfying the crime of violence standard is not an objection sufficient to preserve the claims he now makes, as your question suggested, Judge Kavanaugh, for the first time on appeal. The 2009
If the defense counsel had said something at the sentencing proceeding, for example, that we object to the fact in the pre-sentence report, or the facts are not sufficient here, what would have been good enough to just rely on the no contest plea colloquy?
I don't think so, Your Honor. Under United States versus Lemon, this court has held that when the government's burden of proof is triggered by a dispute to the PSR, the government's allegations would not be enough to satisfy the preponderance of the evidence standard. So in this case, had Mr. Ventura said, court, you cannot rely on these facts. We don't know where they came from. I question their accuracy. The government's got to do something else. Then the government would not have been able to satisfy the preponderance of the evidence burden by just relying on the proffer. They would have had to have done what Mr. Ventura's counsel suggests, such as bring forward the victim to testify, produce some other evidence. But that's not what happened here. Here, as you note, Mr. Ventura said nothing. The district court had nothing before him that would indicate to him that he could not consider the facts for the purpose that he did. And so under this court's clear precedence, the district court was entitled to rely upon facts in an undisputed PSR, and they were in 2009, as established by a preponderance of the evidence, and to consider those facts, as he did, to vary upward from the sentencing guidelines. So that's why there's no error in this case, much less clear error, much less plain error, as we suggest the standard of review would be in this case, Your Honors. I'll move briefly to the claim of substantive unreasonableness and his Sixth Amendment violation claim. First, Mr. Ventura can't satisfy the predicate for his Sixth Amendment violation because he can't show that his sentence was substantively unreasonable but for consideration of the abduction facts. Even if this court were to put those facts aside, the court would see a defendant with a pattern of recalcitrance against the laws of this country. The district court, from the record, it's clear, was very concerned about this defendant's pattern of entry, crime, imprisonment, deportation.
Well, if we thought there was a problem with the abduction, though, we'd have to remand. I know you argue to the contrary, but the district court did seem to take the facts of the abduction as part of his calculus in doing the sentencing. So if there were a problem with the abduction, I think we'd have to remand. Now, you may be making a different argument that just with the abduction included, it's substantively reasonable.
Well, Your Honor, I'm speaking specifically now just to whether he could establish the predicate for a Sixth Amendment claim. Even if this court were to hold that the abduction facts were necessary to the substantive reasonableness of the sentence, that they were so predominant in the record, we would argue that this as-applied Sixth Amendment challenge is not sustainable for the reasons that we stated in our brief. Now, as you suggest, we would argue, as we did in our brief, that there's a reasonable argument here that these abduction facts didn't prejudice Mr. Ventura. They were only mentioned once by the district court, and the district court, it seemed to me, was much more concerned with the fact of the abduction as it related to the pattern of behavior that I stated than he was with the facts underlying the abduction. I think it's arguable that this court would have imposed the same sentence even had he not known about the specific aggravating facts underlying the abduction.
I don't think that's your strongest argument.
It's not, Your Honor, but we don't think you have to reach it. We think you can find that there's no error, and we certainly don't
Thank
think
you
that
for
you
the
need
rare
to find We don't think that you need to find the six.
Not rare on your part, rare on everybody's part.
So, Your Honors, out of an abundance of caution, I'll briefly reach the request for reassignment on remand.
I don't know that we need you.
Then I will. Yes. I will sit down. We ask that this court affirm the judgment of the district court.
Thank you,
Counselor. Thank you.
Okay, Counselor, you can have back 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Your Honor, the government has essentially conceded plain error. If the government agrees that under Lemon there was not a preponderance of the evidence based on this proffer, then it must be clear or plain that the reliance on the proffer was incorrect. So I don't I don't see how this court can rule that it would not be plain if Lemon and due process violations would prohibit reliance on a prosecutor's proffer as sufficient evidence to make a finding by a preponderance that the offense happened.
Well, as I suggested, if this had been raised to the district court and the district court had just said, thank you, I'm still going to rely on the no contest plea colloquy, I think you'd have a very strong argument.
But the government is saying that under Lemon, it's clear that that was not sufficient, that that didn't meet the preponderance standard. If that's true, it must be plain.
What about our precedent on the PSR, relying on the facts in the pre-sentence reports? Good enough.
We've done that over and over, haven't we?
We've done that in Cosley and Pinnock, but this court did limit that in Carter to say that if the defendant, if there was insufficient evidence, the defendant need not come forward to say anything else.
There is sufficient evidence here if we rely on that.
But the government just said there's not.
And I'm not sure why we shouldn't rely on it, and the district court shouldn't rely on it for its own challenge.
It's
been before the district court how many times now?
Three.
And how many of those times did the defense offer any factual challenge to that proffer?
The defense was not required to because the evidence.
No. I didn't ask you whether the defense was required to or not. Listen to me carefully. How many times did the defendant object to make any factual objection, anything in that proffer?
That should be irrelevant to this court's ruling.
Did you hear me ask you whether it was irrelevant or not?
I did hear you. And I believe that pervaded our arguments. That challenge was the essence of all three sentencings.
I take it you're not going to answer my question.
I believe that was the implicit
in our
arguments.
There was never a factual challenge raised to anything in that proffer, was there?
I believe that factual challenge was raised repeatedly, and that if the evidence was...
What's your best record citation to any challenge to the facts in that proffer?
All of our challenges to use of the proffer...
No, your challenges were the use of the proffer. There was never anything that said... That girl made that story up. It was.
If the evidence was insufficient, the district court should have recognized that.
Counsel, I think you do not wish to join my questions, sir. Your time is up and past.
Thank you very much,
Your
Honor.
Thank you, Counsel.